Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Norma Walden, chair of the club's International Relations Forum. We welcome our audience here and on radio and invite everyone to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Our speaker today, Kathy Curtis, has been a registered investment advisor for the last decade and a certified financial planner since 2003. Prior to her career in financial services, she was a sales and marketing executive for Fortune 500 companies in the consumer products industry, such as General Mills, Borden, and the Potlatch Corporation. Her BA in public policy is from UC Berkeley, where she also completed postgraduate coursework in personal financial planning. Kathy is already known to many of you as chair of the Lively Commonwealth Club Bay Gourmet Forum, and she has led several club tours focused on food. Let's welcome Kathy Curtis to tell us about the pros and cons of international investing.
Thank you, Norma. Thank you to the Commonwealth Club and for all of you for spending your lunch hour here with me today. As Norma said, I have been an investment advisor for the last 10 years. I work with individuals and small businesses in their investment portfolio management and also doing comprehensive financial planning. So I take a global look at people's finances as well as looking globally at investments. So you know me a little bit. How about you? How many of you are retired? Okay, so about six of you. How many are employees contributing to a 401k or some kind of retirement plan? Okay, what about self-employed? Okay, a couple self-employed. How many would you consider yourself sophisticated investors? Okay, all right, so I've got some challenges. You might challenge me later. And how about do-it-yourself investors? Most of you? Do any of you have an investment manager you work with? Okay, all right, great. So pretty spread out. I want to try and make this as much value to you as I can, so I want to get to know a little bit about that. My thesis for today's talk is that everyone should be investing globally at least a percentage of their portfolio. And this will depend, of course, on your age, risk tolerance, time frame, et cetera. But the truth is, if you have home bias yourself, if you're afraid to invest overseas, you are missing out on a lot of opportunity in the investment world. The truth is, sad to say, the U.S. is on a decline as far as their economy and their position in the global marketplace. Hopefully, this will change one day, but the trends have been going this way for a while now. And so I am going to start my talk showing you what I'm talking about, how international markets are outperforming, and why you should be putting money in those areas, in a prudent manner, of course. How many of you are afraid to invest overseas? Okay, we have one woman that is, okay. And that is not unusual. Almost every country, a lot of people that live in Sweden or whatever end up investing the majority of their portfolios in their home companies. So that's not unusual at all. All right. So why venture beyond the U.S.? These are very obvious benefits. There's additional investment opportunities in all these various countries. The growth potential is much greater overseas right now than it is in the U.S. Diversification, when international markets are going down, U.S. going up, vice versa. You could so the risk-reward return is balanced when you invest internationally and in the U.S., and I'll talk more about all of these things as we go on. Okay, so I was talking about the U.S. kind of shrinking in the global marketplace. You could see here from this pie chart. Now, this is the developed world. Do you all know the difference between the developed world and the emerging world? Developed world is more stable economies, Europe, the Pacific, excluding China, Canada, United Kingdom, United States. That's the developed world. Economies are stable. The politics are fairly stable. And so that's what we're looking at here. This pie chart does not include emerging markets, which I am going to be talking about because that's a big piece of international investing as well. So if this did include emerging markets, U.S. would probably be about 41% of the total. 10 years ago, U.S. by far was 55-60%. So you could see here that more than half the world is in places other than the U.S. Also, another thing about U.S. gross domestic product, which is the total of goods and services produced in a country, a measure of that, we're now at 24% of global GDP, down from 32% in 2000, and that trend is continuing. This just shows you the developed markets. A lot of these countries are in Europe. This is, if you are an international investor, you need to get real used to this index, the MSCI EFA. It's pronounced EFA. I didn't know that for a long time. How do you pronounce that thing? But anyway, this is an index consisting of these 21 developed market countries. And if you buy a mutual fund, let's say, you're probably going to be benchmarking it against this index in the developed world. These are examples of emerging markets. Have you heard of BRICS, the BRICS countries? Brazil, Russia, India, China. Tell you the truth, I am surprised that China is still referred to as an emerging market. Does that make sense? I mean, they've been growing as fast as rate as any other country in the world for so many years. So there needs to be new terminology, in my opinion. There is a new term called frontier markets that are markets that are even smaller, like Egypt. Oh, no, Egypt they have in here. So there's frontier markets now. They're all lumped together. China's by far the biggest, and India. All right, so this, now we're going to kind of build the case here for investing globally. This portrays the GDP growth by region. The developed countries rate for the last 5 years has been alarmingly low. If you look at Japan, 0% growth. If you look at Canada, 1.3, United States, 1.1. If you look at Brazil, 3.4, China, 10.5. China's been, everyone knows this about China, been growing leaps and bounds. India, pretty much still an emerging economy. They have not come into their own like China has, but they will, and that's going to be a great country to invest in the long term. So you can see the United States is lagging in GDP growth. Okay, so if most of you are not afraid of investing internationally, but if you are, this is a great way to think of it. So many countries, companies domiciled in other countries make products that we use every single day. And U.S. companies have huge overseas businesses. Just as an example, I brushed my teeth this morning with Colgate toothpaste. Colgate has 45% market share of toothpaste in the world. I use my BlackBerry to check my messages. Research in Motion is a Canadian company, 31% of North American market. I wash my face with Kiehl's cleanser, and I use Lancôme mascara made by L'Oreal, the largest manufacturer of cosmetics in the world, headquartered in France, or domiciled in France. I drove to work in my Lexus, of course, Japanese company. We're all doing this. We all use products that are either made here and widely distributed around the United States, or are domiciled in other countries, and they ship all over. It is truly, truly a global marketplace. And then here are some, you can see on the chart, the different companies, and all very, very familiar companies. Okay, so bear with me with the charts. I read a comment today about how somebody hated PowerPoint presentations, and it got me nervous about mine. I'll try and keep it as quick and into. How many people don't mind PowerPoint presentations? Great. It's really the only way to present material when you're talking about investing. So I'm glad to see that you don't mind studying these charts. Okay, so this is the last 30 years global stock market returns. You can see, okay, the blue is the U.S. The next is international in total, and then we break out Europe and the Pacific. the range of returns is much smaller in the U.S., okay? Meaning it's a less volatile, less risky market. You know, United States has been, you know, is a stable economy or in country. The minus 37% is 2008. I'm not quite sure what year it hit, but that was probably like 1999 or something like that. Okay, so the compound annual return in the U.S. over 30 years is 9.9. This is kind of good news because over the last 10 years, the return has been less than one. It's not good. So you could still see over the long haul, you're going to get that magic 10% number if this trend continues. Okay, then international, much higher return in the good year, 70%. A little lower in that was 2008. The international markets got hit very hard. Europe, you could see the spread, and Pacific. The compound annual average return is higher in international markets than it is in the U.S., and it's been that way for a long time. This, of course, means there's risk. Yeah.
Does Pacific exclude China?
Excludes China, yeah. So this means there's risk. When you have this range of return, this is the big issue with international investing. It is risky. So you have to go in there with the right mind frame, long term. You're not going to be able to time the markets. Look at this year with the economic crisis in Europe. International markets got hit a lot harder than the U.S. So you've got to have the guts to stick in there for the long haul, and that's why it's good to look at these charts and see historical numbers. Okay, so what this is trying to portray here is diversification. So you could see the bright red line. Oh, I got one of these little dealy bobs. Is international. Look at over 30 years, international beat these other asset classes, U.S. stocks, international bonds, and U.S. bonds. Now, I'm not saying you should put all your money into international stocks. You got to go back to the risk-reward factor. But definitely, if you want to get some growth, you definitely want to be invested internationally. Okay, so what this shows you is the last 4 years, the top-performing market in each year. 1 year it was Norway. Next, Japan did better than anyone else in the 2000s. Everyone else did. I mean, 29% isn't great, but beat the rest of the countries. Finland in 2007, Spain in 2006. Who would know this, that these countries are going to have outperforming markets in these years? The truth is it's never consistent. There's very rarely when one country's market does well in every single year. But it's also significant. The U.S. has not been in the top-performing markets in 10 years and more. What this tells me is diversify. So you don't want to try and pick the best market. You know, you think Sweden's economy is strong, may do fabulously 1 year. You never know what's going to happen the next. So you want to diversify. But look at the kind of returns you can get in these other places. Okay, so this is another view. This is the last 10 years. The line here in the middle is the U.S. return for that year. So anything above that line did better than the U.S., and anything below it did worse. As you can see, the U.S. is never very high up there over the last 10 years, and there has been no return in the U.S. market over the last 10 years. So you can see that there. Best performing market, Norway, and this should be Australia. That's a typo in Australia. Okay, so I'm just going to do a little talk on why perhaps the U.S. is in the state that it's in, and it has a lot to do with debt. You know the crisis that happened earlier in the year with the unfortunately named pigs countries? Do you know about the pigs? Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain. They have sovereign debt issues, meaning they can't pay back their debt. They've borrowed money from other countries. They can't pay it back. It's high-interest debt, so it's even harder to pay back. Well, the U.S. is not too clean when it comes to debt. We may not have sovereign debt, but we certainly have a lot of fiscal debt, the deficit. And the big problem is, in my view anyway, is that our government is not coming up with solutions. These European countries are really working on austerity measures right now. That's why you're seeing the market stabilize. It's not so scary to invest in Europe anymore. In fact, a lot of international fund managers are investing in Europe, taking advantage of some bargains. But the U.S. is really not doing much. Think about the hard decisions the U.S. is going to have to make. What do we do about social? Our biggest problem is the entitlement program. I mean, we need these programs, but entitlement programs are a tremendous expense. The war. And what politician is going to suggest that we raise the Social Security age again or do something with Medicare? So I don't know what the solution is. And it seems like if it's not being talked about now, when is it going to be talked about? And when will the U.S. get their debt problem under control? Maybe not in the near future. Other developed countries are really trying. The emerging countries, interestingly, don't have as much debt as the developed countries do. They're growing. Their incomes are growing. They're buying more goods. They're exporting. They're importing. So there's a lot more opportunity for growth in the emerging market. A lot more risk as well. Okay, so let's talk about the risk. I've given you the picture about why it would be great to invest internationally, but of course there's risks. Okay, think about when you travel to Europe and you the dollar is strong and you're in Paris and you want to buy a pair of shoes. Well, you're probably not going to buy them because they're going to be too expensive. It's the same thing when you're buying an investment. When you buy a foreign investment, it's bought in the currency of the country that the investment is in. If the dollar is strong, whether the dollar is strong or weak, it's going to make a difference on what you buy the investment for, and then when you go to sell it, what's happening with the currency. Now, there's ways to overcome currency risk. First off, you invest in stable economies that don't have high inflation and things like that. That's not always true of emerging economies. Again, diversification. You don't invest all your money in one pie. You spread it around. It's unlikely that all economies are going to have a currency crisis at the same time, although there was the Asian crisis in 1997. So things are going to happen to disrupt the global economies, but if you take a prudent approach to investing, currency risk should not be one of the things that you worry about the most. It can also be to your advantage. The currency exchange rates can be to your advantage. The other is, of course, that other countries don't have as stable government as we do. There's coups, there's assassinations, there's all kinds of crazy stuff that goes on, and that is definitely going to affect your investments. So, again, that's why maybe a smaller piece in the emerging markets. Accounting standards, China is notorious for not having transparent accounting standards, and that's why a lot of people are very wary of investing in China, even today, as much as they've grown. It's kind of scary to go there. So these are things that you definitely need to keep in mind. Okay, this talks about currency risk. This gives you an example. Okay, so let's take the United Kingdom. So the return in 2009 to the United Kingdom was 27.7%. And then the pound rose against the dollar. So the return to U.S. investors became 43%. So if you were invested in the United Kingdom or any of these other countries in the Pacific region, Japan is the exception. International composite, you made out very well. In fact, right now there's a lot of news about the currency rates and the U.S. market going up or down. It definitely has an impact on the investments. There's not much you can do about that as an individual investor, I have to say. I don't want to make a big deal out of currency. But at the end of the presentation, I'm going to talk about how you can invest in international markets and someone else can manage that currency risk for you, basically. Okay, so this is about standard deviation. Standard deviation is a measure of historical risk in these countries. Okay, so you can see Asia has the highest risk. So Asia includes China, the Pacific, Canada. I'm surprised about Canada's level of risk, to tell you the truth. Europe, next to the UK, Japan, and the U.S. has the lowest risk. This is over the last 10 years. Okay, but this may seem a little bit counterintuitive, but it has been proven over and over that if you just have a domestic portfolio, let's say 60% stocks, 40% bonds, this is over, they're looking over a 30-year period here. The average return, 9.6%. The risk was 11.4%. If you added in even 14% of international stocks, the average return goes up to 9.8%, and the risk level actually goes down. That's because different events in the world affect different markets at different times. And this is why you keep hearing the world diversification. The U.S. has had a horrible couple of years. The rest of the world has too, but the rest of the world seems to be coming out of it. The U.S. is still mired in their high unemployment rates and everything. So there's a balance, and just by adding even 14%, most portfolios are fashioned with between 14 and 20% in international. I'd rarely put more than 20%, basically because of the risk. Okay, so this is a look at risk and return. It's called the efficient frontier. So you see on this axis is the return. Where's my thing? And then here's the risk. So Pacific stocks, we've already talked about this, are the most risky, but they also can provide the highest return. Next, Japanese, U.S., U.K., European. U.S. stocks and bonds are the lowest risk, but also on their own provide the lowest return. So you can build a portfolio with higher return. You could just kind of decide how much risk you're willing to take. When I interview clients for portfolio management, I do a risk tolerance questionnaire and try to get a feel for what kind of risk, what kind of, can they stand it if the markets go down 40% in 1 year? Can you hold on? Because that's really the key. So you could see long term, there's a lot of growth. Okay, we talked about this already. All right, so now we're going to go to the kind of, I think, is the fun part. This has been really fun building this presentation. I knew emerging markets were an exciting area to invest in, but when you look at the numbers, it's really incredible. So these are 10-year returns for emerging markets. Now remember, these are the countries that aren't very stable. Currency fluctuations may happen a lot. They're building their economies. Good things are happening, but there's a lot of risk involved. So emerging Europe, these are like the Slavic countries, Czechoslovakia, Turkey. Well, Turkey's not part of the European Union, but anyway. Then we've got emerging Latin America. Brazil is the biggest country in that arena. Emerging Asia, China, and then emerging Mideast and Africa. And the return number over the 10 years is right here. Just keep thinking back to the U.S., like zero return over the last 10 years. Emerging Europe, 9.5, 18.5, 8.2. Of course, the risk is off the charts, much higher than the developed world or the U.S. Okay, so this is a 20, let's see, how many year view is that? Yeah, 30, still 30 year view of the compound annual returns between developed markets and emerging markets. You can see the 11.8, 9.5, 8.2, Japan has had negative return. And here's some of the emerging markets, Mexico, Korea, Taiwan, and Chile. Their compound annual returns are very good. This is the volatility range, the lows and the highs, much wider than the developed markets. Then this shows you remember that chart where it showed international stocks had the highest return over the long haul? You could see here from 1990 that if you had invested in emerging markets, look at the difference. I think it was $5 difference with the developed. It's quite a big difference here. This shows you compared to the U.S., the 1 year. Emerging markets have been on a tear. This was 2009, over 5 years. This is that 10-year with the U.S. down slightly. And even over longer periods, 20 years, emerging markets has outperformed. Okay, so in between, though, you're going to see a lot of volatility. How many of you think could stomach it over a 20-year period? Yeah, long-term investing is really the only way to go. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit now about how you would go about investing in the international markets. First off, there is a whole array of actively managed mutual funds. Do you all know what actively managed mutual funds are? There's a manager who actually picks the stocks, or a manager or a team of managers usually pick the stocks. They decide what weight to put in which country. There is a prospectus involved where they have to follow the prospectus. So they say they're going to have 80% in developed stocks, then they're going to have 80%. They're going to say they're going to only have no more than 10% in emerging markets. They need to do that. So you can really see how an international portfolio manager puts together the portfolio and if you're comfortable with it or not. You should always read the, how many people read prospectuses? They're kind of interesting reading. You know what's even better reading is the annual reports of mutual fund companies. I brought an example. They're brilliant writers. This is Tweedy Brown Global Value. These guys have been managing international or global fund for 30 years. If you like to read about investments internationally, these annual reports are excellent. I did put a few. I'm not recommending these funds, okay, but I did put a few that I like because they really manage risk and reward well. Does anyone know any of these funds? I love the Scout Fund. It always has a little bit better return than the index, and when markets go down, it doesn't go down as much. That's my favorite kind of stock. You know they're really keeping their eye on the ball. I don't like the funds that try and hit out of the ballpark, and then the next year they're down in the gutter. The Harbor International Fund is a little more of a growth fund, excellent returns. Tweedy Brown's had some struggles, but again, you always have to look over the long haul. Sometimes you just look at the 5 years. This fund isn't any good. You really do have to look at the long haul. Pax World is, I mentioned this one because it's a, I've met the fund manager. In fact, we had a nice talk about this presentation. And she is only been managing the fund for about 3 years. It's a sustainable investing fund. So they screen out tobacco companies and things like that, weapons manufacturers, and they only invest in things that are considered sustainable. She's very sharp. She told me that in their meetings, they put up the numbers of all the different countries, and they don't say which country the numbers are for, GDP growth and debt and all that. And people guess that the U.S. numbers are Greece's numbers. That's how bad the U.S. looks on paper. I mean, it's hard to imagine, but if you just look at the raw numbers, the U.S. isn't looking very good right now. She also told me that she always likes to bring up Japan. Japan was the biggest global economy not very long ago with 35% share. It's now down to 8. So could this happen to the U.S.? I don't know. I mean, when I read about the projections for the U.S., it's that our GDP is going to keep on shrinking. So hopefully something. U.S. is an amazing country, though, right? If we could come up with a new industry or something to get us back on top, it would be a very good thing. Okay, so that's actively managed funds. I personally like actively managed funds. I like to build portfolios of them. I'll find a value fund, a growth fund, a small cap. I like to study what the manager's thoughts are. I read the prospectuses, which you all should do, too. Look at the returns, but keep in mind that you're comparing to a benchmark. So compare to the correct benchmark. In developed world, it's the IFA, and there's a benchmark for emerging markets as well. It's the only way to know whether they're outperforming what everyone else is doing and what the actual index is doing. The other way to invest internationally is with international index funds. A lot of people are passive investors. They don't think that any manager can outperform the market at any time, and this would be the way to go. And actually, this is kind of a no-brainer way to invest. If you want to have exposure to international global, the Vanguard Total International Index Fund is great. The Spartan One's a Fidelity Fund. There's a bunch of these. I didn't list all of them. These are just examples. They basically buy the index. They'll have some emerging, developed. They'll have pieces in every country, and it's not a bad way to go, especially if you don't have a lot of time, you don't want to hire a manager, and you just want to have your 15 to 20% exposure to international markets. There's another investment that's becoming more and more popular, exchange-traded funds. Are you all familiar with exchange-traded funds? Okay, they trade like a stock, so you could trade them all day, which you can't with the mutual fund. They're baskets of stocks. These are some of the most popular emerging indexes. The Emerging Markets Index is one of the most, I have a chart here, the most popular ETFs, and it's by far one of the most popular right now. Basically, if you wanted to invest in any country in the world, you could buy an exchange-traded fund. iShares has a fund for every country. They just came out with an Indonesia fund. There's a Philippines. There's a Sweden, Portugal. I'm not suggesting that's the right way to invest. That's extremely risky. But you could, if you wanted to, build a portfolio of ETFs of various countries. Study the trends in the countries. It'd be kind of a fun and interesting way to invest if you've got the time to do it. Maybe put an international index fund for your broad exposure and then build a portfolio out with exchange-traded funds. That might be a way to do it. Lastly, and I do not recommend this, but for some people who are stock pickers, and I know there may... Who are stock... Is anyone a stock picker? Okay. You can find great stocks. And the safest way to do it is to find U.S. multinational companies that have huge businesses overseas. What could be safer than that? They're domiciled here. They have U.S. accounting standards, transparency, but they sell all over the world. Colgate-Palmolive is a perfect example of that. Or you find foreign stocks of developed or developing markets that sell to the emerging markets. So maybe you don't want to buy a company, an emerging market company itself, but you can find a company in Europe that sells a lot to Czechoslovakia or something like that, and that's a safer way to invest if you're nervous about investing abroad. I think that's a smart way to invest, actually, because if you don't have the time to really research your specific stock investments, you could really, really get hurt. I mean, how many owned AIG in the... owning individual stocks just seems so incredibly risky, and you need to have a big portfolio so that when something goes way down, something else is doing well. Okay, so that's my global investing presentation, and I'm hoping that you found it of value and wondering if anyone has any questions. Yes. Oh, yeah, you can.
Well, the one thing that has always concerned me is I know that we have very strict accounting standards in the United States and we enforce them, and I just don't know how this is done in other countries. I mean, I'm sure some European Western countries are maybe similar to ours, but then when you talk about Pacific or South America, you know, how do they enforce all these standards?
Well, It's very important that you are aware of that, and yes, it is an issue. My only answer is the best way to overcome that is to invest in mutual funds where a manager is traveling to those countries. Actually, they visit the companies and the countries they're investing in, and they will definitely be looking for that kind of transparency. So if you invest with the better mutual funds with a good track record, They're looking at those kind of things. Because there's really right now, they're not on the same accounting standards as we are in the emerging countries. So there's no way to know.
And then that brings up, like, enforcement. Because then I'm counting on, like, an investment manager or the mutual fund manager to see how the standards are enforced or the accounting standards are enforced. Whereas in the U.S., I don't have that concern.
Right. No, that's very true. In your case, you may want to invest in companies that sell a lot of product overseas,
yeah,
so that you know that the accounting standards are there.
Yeah.
And that is a really smart way to invest. A lot less risk, You know, and with your it depends how much more you have to go to for retirement. If you're in retirement, maybe you don't want to take that much risk.
Thank you.
There's lots of companies that you saw the list there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay. Yes.
Can you elaborate more on how the currency influx affects the market in the long run, especially internationally? Like,
yes.
Like the Chinese refusing to devaluate its currency for export purposes, obviously, and Japan just dropped the yen like crazy. So how does that affect?
Well, first off, with China holding their currency steady, it's a lot of mutual fund managers don't have to worry so much about currency fluctuation with China. It actually makes it easier to invest in China, whereas the others, it's just not so easy to predict. The only thing I could say about currency fluctuation is that you can't put all your money into Japan, let's say, or other emerging countries that may have currency fluctuation. You have to diversify. Not every country is going to have currency problems. That's really all I could say. I mean, people are actively investing in currencies right now. There's currency exchange-traded funds. I personally don't go there. Most big mutual fund managers don't use currencies like that. They may hedge into the dollar if they see something going on, but they're not hedging into all kinds of foreign currencies. It's extremely risky, probably some of the most risky kind of investing. So I would stay away from it and invest and diversify your investments. Do you invest in currencies? Is that no?
No.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to figure out the relationship between the fluctuation of the currency and how negatively it might affect the global market.
Well, if the dollar's strong, you're buying things cheaper. If the dollar's weak, they're more expensive. If you sell when the dollar's weak, you may have a loss. You know, you've seen the euro and dollar fluctuate. The value of your foreign investments is changing all the time with the euro and the dollar fluctuating. But that's the way the world is. It's not that big of a percentage of the change in value. I mean, it's not giant. It definitely has an effect. Yeah.
Political situations can change dramatically in some of these countries, particularly some of the emerging markets, and even in Brazil, in some of these countries. So at what point or do you cut bait on a long-term investment? At what point do you do that or do you not? Is that figured into the long-term?
This is what I think about that. If you have an investment, for example, I hold personally the Brazil exchange-traded fund. It has gone over the last. So you either benchmark a price that you're going to sell at. This is what you have to do with all investments. And you sell it, regardless of what's going on. You've got the return that you wanted. If it goes down again, you buy it again. Because personally, though, I think over the long haul, if you're building a portfolio for retirement, you should just hold on. If you're investing to make money all the time now, which some people are, you want to have some money to use now, then I think I would set a benchmark and sell when it reaches that benchmark. And then watch it. If it goes down to a level you want to buy again, buy. Or trim your position. Don't sell all of it. Sell some of it. So that's a great way to do it, because then you don't think, oh, my God, I bailed out of Brazil, and now look what's happening in Brazil. You still hold a position in Brazil. A lot of mutual fund managers will do that. They'll hold a big position in a company like Nintendo, keeps going up. They trim some of it. They don't sell at all. It'll go through its downturn. Then it'll come back up. So I think that's the only – because you can't really predict. But it's definitely going to have some of this going on. Does that help? Anybody else? Yeah.
What do you think of hedge funds as a way to invest?
I like hedging strategies, actually. Most people can't invest in them because you have to be an accredited investor with so many in assets and things like that. However, there's some great products out there, mutual funds, et cetera, that do use hedging strategies, and I do use them for a small, this again, small percentage of a portfolio. Some funds buy long and short. They go long stocks or short. I think it makes a lot of sense, especially right now. In fact, most diversified portfolios right now do have a certain percent in alternative investments of some kind. So a hedge fund is considered an alternative investment. So, yes, I think it's the world's too crazy. You got it, to me, I think of it as a little bit of insurance. You know, this is, I don't know if anyone's going to ask me about gold, but I was listening to some managers talk about gold, and a lot of people are buying gold right now, and they go, well, if you really need to buy gold, the world's going down. So, why are you buying gold? Fact is, gold has been performing unbelievably well. So as an investment, it's been fantastic. But, why are you holding it? You're holding it because you think the world's coming in, and the whole rest of your portfolio is going to hell. So as a short-term strategy, great. As a long-term, I'm not so sure. If you saw gold over the long-term, it has not done anywhere near as well as it is now. It is, that's sort of a hedging strategy too, actually. I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know. I think most African countries are considered frontier. They're like not even on the map yet as far as investment. South Africa, yes. But I can't think of very many others that are investable. I mean,
the Chinese are investing in Africa heavily.
Yeah. Well, maybe they see something that we don't.
Oil.
What? Maybe it's probably resources. Yeah. It's probably in commodities, not in companies. Yeah. I think Africa's very risky. That poor country just cannot seem to get itself off the ground. It's corrupt. All the regimes are corrupt. People aren't making any money. There's no income. So there's no spending. And so it's probably in commodities that China's looking at. Yeah.
What other parts of the world have had a housing crisis comparable to that of the U.S., if any?
Definitely Europe, and that's one of the big problems in Ireland and Spain. They had booming. And did anyone go to Ireland in the last several years, before the crisis? Apparently it was the most amazing turnaround of any country, but now Ireland is like the worst, as far as GDP, the worst performing economy over the last 10 years. So, yes, most of Europe had a very similar housing crisis. And they had lots of mortgage debt and funny loans and all those things just like we did. Yeah. And they're trying to come out of that now as well.
China may.
Say, I'd like to.
China may end up having that too.
Yeah. Yeah, China is a very interesting country because you can't ignore it, but there's so many things there, you don't really know what's going on there. You know there's tons of consumers. They're going to be buying all kinds of products, and what a global marketplace. But then there's all these things that you cannot predict. And I think you need to be a little bit in China, though. I mean, definitely. And if you invest in any emerging mutual fund or exchange-traded fund, you will definitely have a big part of it in China, China and India both.
Our thanks to our speaker, Kathy Curtis, registered investment advisor and certified financial planner, for sharing her views on international investing. We also thank our audience here and on radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, enjoying its second century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.